Red Dice Diaries podcast, a rambling journey through the wonderful world of RPGs by a longtime GM and player. The music at the start of this podcast is Shinigami by Tarek, used under Creative Commons license. Okay, and welcome to this live and uncut podcast recording. I have Dennis, Johannes, Andre and Matthew here, and we're going to talk about production values in RPGs, and more specifically, how much production is too much. So, does anyone want to kick us off? Anyone got strong opinions about this subject in particular? Who wants to just jump in and like grab it and be like, argh!
I have pretty strong opinions, but they fluctuate from being for and against it. And what I mean by it is, I don't like companies that publish books in excess just for the sake of sustaining their company and not developing their product lines so that they're of any interest to those who are participating in buying their products. And that is one thing that I have found with a lot of the larger publishers as an entry level participant in a game. It's almost overwhelming to take on a new game. And I see this with players like we have some new players in our V5 game, for example.
Yeah,
that have not touched any vampire books. And reading V5, while it is a task in itself to read V5, getting past that task, there's an unlimited amount of resources that a new player would just not know about unless they're counseled and brought and nurtured into that culture of gaming. And saying, okay, well, now that you've read V5, let's go in the past and read 438 source books so that you can actually understand what's going on. So I understand that, well, World of Darkness is a bit different in a sense where the actual source books are very interesting. So they're not committing the crime that I'm, like, really angry against. But I think certain franchises that, like Pathfinder, they just overdo it. And it just drives me bananas.
Yeah, I mean, I think when sort of like larger companies get to a certain stage with an established game line, when, let's face it, realistically, we know that they've sort of covered everything that really needs to be covered. They've pretty much got one or sort of two options, as far as I've seen it. They can either bring out a new edition, and D&D is pretty fucking famous for this. You know, you squeeze everything you can out of that, like D20, and then you bring out a new edition, or you just keep pumping out supplements that unfortunately steadily get like less and less in value. And I know Dennis, Johannes, and myself, we've talked about the much maligned like World of Darkness combat supplement.
Oh yeah,
which
that good shit.
Which, as far as I'm concerned, I never needed to happen. There was never, like, any... I was never sat around, like, one day after playing that vampire going, well, wouldn't it be amazing if there was, like, a whole book chock full of, like, nothing but combat manoeuvres and, like, stats for, like, different weapons? I mean, that's not a book I'd want for, like, any other supplement, let alone, like, White Wolf's or World of Darkness, which always prided itself on being, like, a storytelling system. But I think once they got to that sort of point, everything that they needed to be covered had been pretty much covered. So again, you're faced with this choice of, do you bring out a new edition, or do you just keep like churning out them books?
It's a good thing they stop before they start publishing books like that, huh? I mean, we certainly needed a Succubus Club 2. That was the most needed book. That's the combat book. So
to be honest, I've not even got any memory of like the Succubus Club 1 book, never mind like the Succubus Club 2 book.
Club 1 was kind of like, maybe because this was my first experience with it, so I kind of like, oh, this is neat, this is like a 90s edgy, and it's in a warehouse with this club, and there's vampires and weird shit.
See, I just like read it, and I was like, oh, Succubus Club, and I was like, aren't they supposed to have like a masquerade? Because could you like make any more obvious a vampire club?
Yeah.
I mean, you may as well have just like had like vampires sort of like, with their fangs out, like shaking the groove thing on top of the roof, and it wouldn't have been any more obvious.
I mean, there used to be kind of like, I guess a saying or whatever you call it, where they would make the most money, a publishing company would make the most money when they put out a new edition, because that would sell, and then they would start producing all the source books and all the materials again, and it would taper off. So I guess to stay alive, they kind of need to, but
and
I
also,
do feel...
Like, or, sorry to interrupt you, but, like, that's one thing, like, to keep, like, the lights on, obviously, but there's also, like, they, like, back in the day, at least, not so much anymore, like, these companies, like White Wolf, they had agreements, contracts, basically. This is how I understood it, anyway. I don't have insider information from White Wolf, but this is how I understood that they operated. So they had contracts with like distributors, so bookstores, basically. And to fulfill those, they had to keep to a certain schedule, like produce new stuff.
On one side, I feel like it's just excess to keep a company going and to make sure jobs are sustained and all that stuff. And while that's a positive thing, the other side of me says, you know, really? Why? You know, because all you need to do is just provide a book with core rules and everything else is basically up to the imagination of the players. But another thing that I... don't like is the distribution of materials and many books that can be done in one book.
Yeah.
Oh, that drives me bananas. I'll give a good example. Fantasy Flight Games character archetypes in Star Wars. Like, you get one character archetype in, you know, one splat book, and then you have to wait 7 months or 6 months to get another. It's just horrible, and I hope that trend doesn't continue in the industry, because it's wasteful of my money. Am I muted again? Okay, sorry.
No.
It's wasteful of my money, and it's a money suck, and it's kind of like not cool to do that to your consumers. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I played Shadowrun since the first edition.
Mm-hmm. I feel for you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, dude, if I could reach out and physically hug you now, I would do. I thought you were going to say, like, oh, I've been playing like Shadowrun for like about 5 years and I'm still genning that first character.
Yeah, it's like you go to the used bookstore and you find old 3.5 books and like one of them is clothing and linens. You're like, are you fucking serious, dude? This is too much. Stop. And I get that. The excess is felt when there's also no restrictions. But there is a point, and the one thing that it's kind of like a catch-22, because the liberty that people had to produce with D20 really was revolutionary to the industry, you know what I mean? Open gaming license, all that. That was amazing. But then, you know, on the opposite end of that, you just have, you know, countless productions that are just unworthy of your time. And how do you sift through all that data?
Well, and, like back when. I played a little 5e. I was looking at what is called DM's Guild, and I kind of like stopped because I couldn't get an overview of what was good and what was not good, and that's just too much produced for my taste, at least.
I mean, I've got to admit, that is one of the things I do like about this sort of like the official like release schedule for D&D 5th edition. It seems, certainly from my point of view, that they're more sort of like drip feeding stuff slowly in, and they're sort of doing like more sort of like campaigns and adventures and stuff like that, which seems quite cool. But it's not just like here's like a massive load of like books released in quick succession like it was with like 3.5, which it's all right at the start, but you burn through all the good ideas within about like 3 weeks, and then where do you go?
Yeah, you start with the player's handbook number 3, and you're like, well, I guess. But I believe the, I don't remember if it was Mike Merles or who from the current like D&D team, but like this was one of the things that they recognized, that they wanted to do, like, right off the bat. Like, they wanted to start 5th edition off, like, with a heavy hand on the moderation toggle for releases, so that they wouldn't, like, swamp their own product, basically. Like, just, like, focus on... I forget his exact words, but it tied into like class design as well, because they changed that, because one of the driving forces for 3.5 was the classes, prestige classes, core classes, whatever classes you could get. That was one of the like big things that sold books.
So. Another thing that he had said on that note when he was actually, I saw that video, and what he had said was when they introduce books, the material that's within it has to feel playable and applicable to everything that you're doing, and it has to open up and feel like when you open up a book and you read one of their source books, like Zanathar's Guide to Everything, you have to read that book and want to play what's in there. If you don't get the feeling that you want to play it, then the book is a failure. And that's the way they wrote them. They wrote them in a way where everything provides and motivates playability that's new and scalable and fun and easy to reach. And I will say it firsthand. I love the way D&D is distributing books. I love the way they're pacing it. And I love the fact that they're releasing more adventures that have content that can be easily portable to other games and other adventures. It's like getting source material and an adventure together in one book, so you're getting the best of both worlds.
See,
I like that.
I do like that as well. My only slight concern is that it's going to go a bit sort of like the FFG Star Wars way, where after a certain point, are they going to start like repeating stuff? Because I certainly felt, I know they had like three separate game lines, like your Edge of the Empire, Age of Rebellion, and Force and Destiny for FFG Star Wars, but there was a lot of stuff that felt like it was repeated between various supplements, whether it be aliens or types of ship or antagonists or whatever.
One thing to consider is like if there is a sort of a demand for these kind of books, can you really blame the publishers for putting out? Because if there's a demand for, say that you don't know anything about martial combat, for example, and then they produce this book all about, you know, fighting styles, you know, much.
I mean, I think that's a very valid point. I mean, is it something of like a self-fulfilling prophecy? Because as we've been saying, you've got people who sort of like want to have like a completist urge to like have like the complete collection of books.
Many times we've discussed like D&D, for example, and we've talked about all campaign settings that aren't currently in 5th edition, and people are like, we really want that to be brought in 5th edition, we want them to port it, you know, bring it to a modern audience. So I mean, if that's what people want, is it can you blame them for putting this content out there? Well, it's not needed, but it's what people want to buy.
It feels like a lot of the books were made for the players, because the players seems to be the ones who has the craving for new classes, new spells, new feats, new mechanics.
From my perspective, the readability of buying a book like Storm King's Thunder, actually, see, there's two things that are happening, many things that are happening, but one of the two things that are happening here is they're releasing out adventures, and while they're releasing out adventures, they're updating video games, and they have these campaigns being published in videos through Critical Role or whatever. So they have a marketing scheme where they can actually produce adventures that introduce new rules. They have a multifaceted approach on how they develop these tool sets, but the driving force behind D&D 5th is story. It's not content. For me as a reader and as a consumer, as a player, and as a DM, that's a more interesting way to read a book. The story allows me to unfold and rethink the ideas that they present to me, so I become much more of a creative person.
It's an interesting point. Just to break in there, we've got a person in the chat room on Twitch who's watching this, who said, on the flip side, though there are blatant flaws in the game, they're talking about 5th edition, that could be addressed with new content, which they're not doing. And they're saying, at the end of the day, Kobold Press is getting 250k to make a monster manual too. and the most talked about features from the new books that aren't campaigns in the community are always the new mechanics and the character options. So thank you for that comment. And again, I think you are absolutely right. You make a good point. As we're saying here, I mean, it's difficult to separate out at what point it's the company putting out a book because they know it will sell, or if it's being motivated more by people who will just buy whatever is put out because they want it as part of their collection.
I mean, one thing that we could all agree on is that it's working for them.
I mean,
as compared to 4th edition, 5th edition is, even 3rd edition, 5th edition is just an amazing success.
Yeah. I mean the thing is, at the end of the day, and I don't say this to be disparaging of the companies that are producing role-playing books, but they are companies. Companies, like we said earlier, they've got to keep the lights on, they've got to pay the staff, they've got to pay for whatever premises, whatever computer equipment and hardware they're using. All of that has got to be paid for, and that revenue is raised by whatever game lines they're putting out. So if you've got like a sort of, if you're a company that's mainly only doing like a single sort of flagship line, and you've not really got like a diverse portfolio of products, then you need to keep that line. You either need to diversify, or you need to keep that line going in order to like put money in the bank effectively.
Yeah, and I think like, because like you said, companies need to make money. It's the reason that many of them exist.
I mean, if I was playing D&D, I would prefer to have it. Like Andrew described.
You are playing D&D, Dennis. You're playing my game. So it's our game.
That's not D&D. Let me keep my illusions. I would prefer to have, like they do with 5e, as Andrew describes. I would like to have the campaigns and stuff, because I can use that as a GM. Like, if you take Pathfinder, I know I was looking at the online reference, and there's so many options.
It's so unapproachable as a game, Pathfinder. I mean, for me personally, I know guys, you know, I talk to girls and guys, and they're like, hey, you know, all you gotta do is read the core book, and from there, you know, just pick the direction you wanna go. But even getting through the core book, I'm like, oh my God, this is so boring. It is just so much content and so many options. But that, I think, is really just my preference for low crunch settings.
Yeah.
And I will push the OSR button now. And say that I prefer the open role-playing style of gaming. And probably the most crunch that I've ever played any game has been Vampire, I would think. The style in which they are writing these books is, for me, the future of RPGs. It really seems that way. Present a story, provide the world, give a little piece of the campaign world, give some character options, give a bunch of stuff, give new items, new spells, but at the same time, while you're doing that, tell a story so that it's interesting while you're reading the book, because I don't want to read a manual, like Dennis said. It's just boring.
I mean, I think for me, I don't have a problem with slightly like higher crunch sort of games, to use a term. I think my issue is where the amount of crunch in the game doesn't really feel justified. Certainly in 5th edition, I've never found there's so many choices that like you have to spend ages like toting up your bonuses and working out what's cumulative and what's not.
I think it's the repetition factor that you mentioned before. You know, when you read D&D 3.5 and you've read 1,500 feats and maybe 20 or 30 of them are the same but just different wording, you know what I mean?
And it feels like back when I was playing Magic the Gathering, right? You had the core book, the core deck, and you went out and, oh, there's a new deck series out, and you bought those, and you're kind of like, oh, this is kind of like this other card I have, but cheaper or better.
Yeah, well, I was just going to talk about the, because Andre mentioned that the 5th edition stuff is like story driven in the design aspect of it. So you have these not really stories, like Xanathar's Guide to Everything isn't like a campaign book, but it has an overarching thing that it's about. And I thought that, because we mentioned that they are writing quite a lot of like adventures, and I will have to say that Tomb of Annihilation is some of the best shit put into print for D&D, because it is an adventure, but it's also like you could just like forget about that particular adventure, and now you have a fairly good primer for Chult.
You don't need a source book. You've got it all there, and it's in the adventures. Like, everything is fucking there. And it's just, it's amazing. I agree 100%. Like, books.
Well, our commenter, who's going by the handle of Go Get Me Tacos, very nice.
Get them tacos.
Says, does 5th edition really give you enough storytelling tools, though, or does it just rely on the experience of older generations who don't need the resources as much as new players? How do you do D&D 5th edition without homebrewing almost every aspect of the game? Now, I don't think you really need to homebrew an awful lot. I think you could do a lot with the course of a player's handbook, DMG, and the monster manual. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a fan of like the OSR, so I'm a big fan of the whole lot of rulings over rules style deal. Yeah.
So I really think you can get a lot of miles with that, but I do think it's kind of like you have to play a lot of games to know what to tinker with and what to leave alone.
I'll give you an example of not relying on old school players to and house ruling. Basically, just with the player's handbook, the monster manual, and the DMG, my daughter's middle school D&D club, they're strictly staying to the rules as best as possible. They're trying to learn the rules very well. That's like the goal of the group. And so they're not really house ruling anything. The only thing that they're using improvisationally or developing improvisational wise is the story.
They haven't played any role-playing game before, right?
Yeah, no role-playing games at all. They're just going into it, open mind. Yeah. And they're reading the book, and they're saying, okay, we're just going to take it a step at a time. It's very academic. They're just going about, we're going to take these rules and test them out, but this is what our session is going to have as a test bed for these rules. And they're going to do that every Wednesday for the entire school year throughout middle school.
I think as well, to go to another point the comment has made, where he's saying that he doesn't think the Monster Manual and the DMG don't do enough. Like he gives the example of there's not a good way to design traps in 5th edition. Well, my thing about that is that I agree that what you're saying is it doesn't hurt if you've got like a bit of like old school experience to like be able to like come up with these things on the fly, but you only get that experience by like just trying things out and seeing what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And it's like, let's face it, if you make like a trap and you're like, oh, I'm gonna make a pit trap, and you're like, oh, I can't remember exactly how much like damage like falling fucking 50 feet does. Well, I'm gonna say it does like 2d12 hit points damage or whatever.
Oh, I would say 50d8.
Yeah, that's because you're hardcore, Dennis. Dennis would be like, oh, there's like an ochre jelly at the bottom, and a huge pile of GURPS supplements like slides in afterwards and buries you alive.
And you kind of need to start at that level. You need to learn the tricks and the ins and out. I mean, one lesson I learned that helped me a lot was stop caring with the game balance and just.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I can see the commenter's point. I suppose what he's trying to say, and obviously feel free to correct me, commenter, if I'm wrong, that initially, in order to like build up this experience, you need sort of some basis for comparison.
Yeah, and like it's the same when you encounter any, like I'm going to say system, but I don't specifically mean like gaming systems, but any pattern that you encounter for the first time. And if you don't have anything you can reference in that moment, you're probably going to go, huh? So I think that's just a hurdle, really. Like, there's no way around that except it's just, like, hit that head on and be like, what the shit? And then just sit on it and read it and try to figure it out because it's new, right? It's a new shape, and you don't have the receptacle in your mind for that, necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, but on the opposite end of the spectrum, John, are there games that have too few books? Have you ever encountered a game like that? Because that's
nope.
Right? Right? Isn't that the case? There's no game that has too few books, but there's always games that have too many.
Well, I think as the commenters were saying, you can, of course, obviously, house rule absolutely anything you want. So if there's too little stuff, you can always expand on it yourself. Whereas, I think not everyone. I think some people, if there's a lot of stuff out there, some people do feel like there's an onus to sort of use everything that's out there, you know, rather than sort of.
Yeah, that's particularly true for World of Darkness, right? Because you had these people back in the day who had read the like 700 books that they came out with, including Combat 1 and Combat 2.
Yeah.
And
there it is.
And like they would know. They had memorized every single setting detail that had been alluded to in like book number 675, and then you're running your game, and they would go, "No,
yeah.
Doesn't don't work like that."
The word actually,
don't get me wrong. If someone's like, I've memorized like every role in existence for like D&D 5th edition or whatever, and I know it all off by heart, you can just be like, "Oh, what's the damage on like a 20-foot fall on a Tuesday, September the 13th, when the wind's blowing from the southeast at 5 miles an hour?" And you can just be like, boom, 2d6 minus one or whatever. Fair play to you. But for fuck's sake, don't expect me to have memorized that bullshit, because I won't have done.
I mean, back when we were playing Vampire the Masquerade Revised Edition.
Back in the 90s!
Yes, in my day!
I had a player, and he had memorized all the disciplines. So instead of fighting that, when I had something, instead of looking it up, I'll just ask him. So I'll just employ his eidetic memory for memorizing disciplines. And I really hated looking up in those books because it was so difficult to look.
I think there's a correlation actually to some of the sort of popular and also like personally to me appealing OSR products compared to like what we were just discussing. Yeah. John's having a moment there. So with the D&D like Tomb of Annihilation, okay, we outlined the good stuff in that, and I think there's a whole bunch of it in there which is very similar to some of the OSR products. And I'm basically talking about OSR setting / adventure books, just like Tomb of Annihilation is. Like, you have a thing you can do pre-built in, but also there's the thing that contains that specific adventure, which is also usable to you.
I think to use, carry on with the example of like Tomb of Annihilation as well, I mean, I don't use a lot of like published adventures. Nothing wrong with them. I just don't tend to use a lot of them. But I was lucky enough to play some of the Tomb of Annihilation with Andre running it. And as you say, it's like it provides a lot of like additional like flavor and a few extra mechanics specific to that sort of thing, that jungle exploration of Chul. There were things during that where I was like, oh, that's a good idea. I might use that in a future game. I might use that. So even if I didn't buy the book, and I've got like a PDF copy, but even if I didn't buy the book myself, and I never planned to like run the Tomb of Annihilation, there was still stuff in it that I think would add value to a 5th edition game if I was running them. Or even if I was running a game where I potentially wasn't using those rules, the way they've sort of constructed them might give me something to think about if I was running a different game.
Yeah, I think that takes us back to, you know, when is too much, right? And we've talked about different development of books and splat books and their uses, but ultimately, in the end, if they're motivating creativity, then they're a good splat book.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things I like about the recent sort of V5 release. I mean, I'm not saying by any means it's a perfect game. I don't think any game's like 100% perfect. It's definitely not. Let's just put that out there. However, one thing you can say about it is it's very obvious from reading it that the people who are writing it are sort of in love with that whole idea of Vampire the Masquerade, and it's something they feel passionate about.
I think one of the major defining factors of that book and books like it are when you talk about writers that enjoy writing for the game that they love so much, the one thing that is evocative that comes out in their writing is the ethos of the book. You know what I mean? Like, it's so the ethos of V5 is so strong. You know you're playing a different game than V20. That's a success to me.
It's an interesting point as well. We're talking about that potentially there's two different roads a company can take once they reach that point where, like, they've wrung all the ideas they can out of a game line, when they have to either sort of like just keep pumping out stuff for the sake of it or making a new edition. So let's say that this fictional company, they've reached a point where they're like, right, we need to bring out a new edition, we can't do it. I think it's a difficult time for any company, because as we say, these companies have to like keep money coming in, that's how they keep running and making products. But I think quite often you'll see companies where they're releasing a new edition where they want to make it new and they want to like bring, like revitalize the game line, but there's only so far they can move away from what they've done previously, because obviously they've got to sort of keep their like their core demographic, their sort of their fan base. So you for instance, so V5, there's a lot of stuff that's different in it, but White Wolf, there's a lot of stuff that's similar in it, like, you know, it still uses D10 dice pools.
I think it's certainly more appealing to me than this new edition has its own distinguished flavor than the previous edition, because then I would be interested in it.
There's always going to be people that hate a new edition. I mean, it just always happens. We see the revision wars in D&D going back 40 years, you know? So it's like at some point in time, a company just needs to say, you know, we got to make a new game.
I mean, one of the things I do like about it as well is, as well as the sort of core conflict in the game, which, as you say, cause it's always supposed to have been like a game of personal horror, and I really do feel they've tried to like take it back to that. There's also like a sort of second layer of like conflict sort of like interwoven with that, which is the fact of you're embraced, you're turned into a vampire or whatever fairly recently, and not only have you got like, oh well, I'm losing my links to my humanity, I've got to feed on blood, I can no longer go out of the day, I can't eat, etc. You've also got that whole conflict of when you like wake up and you're like, oh, all the cool sects have disappeared, and all that's left are these scuzzy anarchs.
Where's my Talmahera?
The true hand.
I had a moment when I was watching the World of Darkness documentary, when Mark Ranhagen looked at the camera and he says, "Now you could be the bad guy." And I think that that's really what old classic World of Darkness was, and V5 is more about, now you can feel fucked.
Do you guys think that there's any sort of other options? Like, if you were running a company and you got a massively successful role-playing game line, and you got to the point where like the fans were like, "Oh, we don't really need like combat book version 5. Oh, no more combat maneuvers."
More assault rifles.
Exactly. And you were sort of in charge of the company, like the creative direction of that company. Do you think there are any other options beyond releasing a new edition or just continuing to like pump out a steadily decreasing quality of books?
Well, I think quite a lot depends on the company itself, like what their thing is, basically. Are they a one-game company? Because if you are, then those two are probably what you're going to go for. But like thinking of the new Swedish White Wolf that we have going on now, like they have, everything is like laid out for them. Like they're going to make a new edition of Werewolf. I'm thinking they have to make a mage as well. And like they basically have this like catalog of stuff that they can now just riff off of, and each one of those releases will probably pick up quite a lot of eyes and cash as well, I would think. So they have this sort of like option 2.5, which is, we're going to do what we did to V5 to these other game lines that you guys love, and we're going to have like our own selection of shit to do. I wonder if there's room there for new, like brand new lines, though, which is something I would really be interested in. Like, after these guys knock out, let's say, the core three, so Vampire, Werewolf, Mage, I would like to see these guys go, and then this.
I think the potential issue with that, though, is like, traditionally speaking, each White Wolf game has been sort of like, right, this game line focuses on monster X, whether it be vampires, werewolves, wraiths, whatever. And I think, really, there's only so many sort of monsters mm-hmm. that you can cover. I mean, we saw that a bit with, like, the New World of Darkness, where they're putting out sort of different books, and you started getting into, like, Beast the Primordial, which, you know, I think's a horrendous book. But it's like someone read, like, you know, like the stereotypical, like, angsty introduction to, like, an old World of Darkness book, and then went, oh, let's turn that up to 11. And it's all sort of like, you are playing the darkness that lurks inside mankind's souls. It has been there since the dawn of time, but now it is embodied in you and steps out onto the street.
It certainly sounds like Wonderful.
Well, that's it. It almost went so far, to my mind, it went so far over the top that it almost became like a parody of a World of Darkness game.
Can I go back to an earlier point about production?
Yeah, of course. What, you mean the central point of this video? Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, well, I had a thing that Andre said, and it's sort of something that I've come across myself. It's to do with actual story elements. So, like, when a book's like, here's our de facto campaign setting, and it is literally like a novel long. Because I had a discussion with one of my groups, and they really wanted me to run Marvel, for example. And I've always said, I'm not the right person to run Marvel, because I am not immersed in that universe to the degree where I could run it with the knowledge. You know, I feel obligated to give them the best game I can, so I'd feel like I need to know that universe through and through, which is just a, you know, it's far more of a task than actually running the game. So my point is it up for production when they just dump this really intricate meta plot or campaign story, narrative, whatever you want to call it, or is it more important just to give the GM or player story hooks to jump off of?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's two different ways of approaching a game. I mean, obviously the benefits of, if you've got like a sort of strong meta plot, as a company you can always advance that meta plot and sort of use it to bring changes into your game world, and you can sort of extend the shelf life, for want of a better term, of a game line by doing that. So we saw that in the Old World of Darkness when they brought in like the Time of Thin Blood originally.
Part of the Old World Darkness was that there were so many, at least where I live, that bought all the books just to read them. They never played the game. They just liked the Mythic Blood story, so they wanted all the sources to that they could get their hands on. I never got that much into that. So I mean, it's cool, I guess, but I was more focused on whatever city I had decided we were playing in. Or maybe I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's one of the sort of like the core sort of paradoxes, if you will, at the heart of RPGs. As we've said before, it's like technically, if you want to just like run a role playing game, you don't even need to like buy a core book. If you just wanted to be like, right, let's make some shit up and just like crack on, you could do that, but it's handy to have at least some sort of structure. But
so what would you say then in terms of production, like when is a player or a GM getting their value for money? Like at what point do you think, yeah, I've got this book's done me some good? Like, so, you know, if you use it once, is that enough? Or is it like if you've used it a couple of times, or if you actually copied parts of it and used it in multiple different systems?
I think for me personally, it's if I get a book and I read it and I think, right, that book's only going to be of use for this particular game, I don't get a lot of use out of it. Because, like, if say I go, well, I don't know, what have I got? Like, if I go, I'll go Kindred of the East, for an example. If I go, like, right, I've got my Kindred of the East books, so I've got, like, about 10 books for the Kindred of the East lines, dealing with, like, the Quajin, the sort of Eastern Kindred. Mm-hmm. I'm unlikely to use the stuff out of that in any other game, unless I'm running a Kindred of the East game. And with the best will in the world, I'm maybe going to run a few of them during my life because I've got like, other games I want to be running. Whereas if I've got a book where I'm like, I mean, I think that's why I like things like D&D are so popular, because one, people run a lot of D&D, but also because there's like broad cross compatibility with like the LSR games, D&D, D&D 3.5, stuff like that. You can always look at those. I mean, it's why I've kept a lot of my old D20 books, even though I don't plan to run D20, because I can look at the stuff in those books and very easily take inspiration from them for use in like, other games that I will run. So I'm getting more bang for my buck, effectively.
So it's, I mean, that kind of sums up a lot for me, because once I'm not inspired by a book, I mean, if a source book is so bad that I can't get inspired by it, I can't modulate or use anything modular wise out of the book. I don't get new rules. It's just a source book of statistics, tables, and maps. When that happens, I just like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a valid point, but to go back to the example of like the Tomb of Annihilation, like the sort of chult book we were talking about earlier. I think that's interesting partly because it is like a sort of primer on like jungle exploration and stuff like that. But how, again, as we were saying with like with White Wolf, and we're saying how many different types of monster are there in terms of like different types of terrain and like cities and stuff like that, how many of them are there that it's possible to do before you're like, oh, we're doing like jungle exploration book two or whatever.
Yeah, I think primers work well, and I think that's an OSR kind of culture.
We've got an interesting comment from the Taco Man in the comment box, where he's saying, "Do us guys own any third party content for 5th edition?" I don't know about you guys. Have any of you guys got any third party content for 5th edition? I can see Matthew nodding away.
Yeah, I have a player. Sorry. I have a player who, like the discipline guy from Vampire, he's memorized the entire monster manual of the original 5th edition, which became a little bit of a problem sometimes because, you know, you want to create a surprise, and you know, every time I describe a monster, you'd be like, oh, it's this with this stats and this, and it kind of like, for the people who don't know what it is, it kind of takes away. So I picked up I think it's Cobalt Press, the Tome of Beasts. And I've never told him where I've got the book from, and I just occasionally drop them in there, and, you know, great book, just to spike.
Yeah, for me, it's Tome of Beasts, too. I like Tome of Beasts so much that I bought the hardcover, and I got the module inside of Roll20 Legends.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of the Raging Swan Press stuff, because I support them on Patreon, and they do a lot of sort of... I suppose sort of like drag and drop content where they'll be like, oh, here's a book where it's like a little PDF or whatever, and it's like a town or a city with its own specific like problems and NPCs that you can just like drop into a game.
Can I just say, does buying stuff on Roll20 count?
I think in your case it does, yeah.
I am completely addicted to buying everything on Roll20.
For me, the third-party stuff that I have, because from 5e, like the official stuff, I have the Player's Handbook because I was in a 5e game, and the Tomb of Annihilation because I heard so much good about it, and that's it. I went to the DM's Guild actually, and I bought a bunch of like Tomb of Annihilation add-on stuff, like just more stuff to put on the map because there's a lot of space there, right?
Yeah, those are those are awesome. I love them.
Yeah, so I snatched like 10 of those. I'm like, yeah, give me some of this shit.
Yeah, I mean,
like I did that with Storm King's Thunder. I got like all the excess mods, like going deeper into the maps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Awesome stuff. That was one thing that I think that's probably the most fun, like, and most important purchases I've made in the DM's Guild is, you know, all of this extra stuff that players say, yeah, you bought Storm King's Thunder, but look at this, and then they just give you all these, you know, extra things. I love this. Yeah, I don't mind it at all. I mean, I think that for example, when you buy Tomb of Annihilation and you want to know more about Chult, you can just buy, you can just review the second edition book and do that. But there, you know, a lot of the creativity that these guys bring to the table in the DM's Guild and a lot of the detail that they bring to the table goes beyond even that second edition book and just gives you some neat options. So, I mean, I don't think that that's a bad thing, and I support it. It's cool.
Yeah, the inherent thing, like, if we're looking for some negatives to this, like, fan fest, obviously when you have an open platform, well, open to an extent, obviously, but, like, as open a platform as the DM's Guild is, DriveThruRPG, and because White Wolf did the same thing, right? Because you have the Storyteller's Vault. So now you have the exact same model for White Wolf games. There's going to be a couple of things that happen. There's going to be a lot of stuff on there, and a lot of it is just going to not be worth your time.
I was going to say, you know very well your drive-through page just takes you like straight to like products published by Kevin Crawford.
Yeah, it does, but that's like I paid for that. Like my drive-through just like edits everything except Kevin Crawford's Sin Nomine publishing products.
Well, we've had an interesting point raised by one of the commenters in the chat box on Twitch, where they're making a comment about how good or not the DM's Guild is for the actual creators who publish stuff on there. Now, I've got to confess, I don't actually know much about the DM's Guild policy towards people who create stuff and sort of publish it online. I don't know if any of you guys have any thoughts or like input on that. I've never published anything there myself, so I don't know what hoops they have to jump through or anything like that.
Yeah, don't know about the split, right? Because that's usually where these discussions go. Like, how much do you get?
Yeah.
And I absolutely have no idea.
That dollar?
Yeah. Them dollar bills, y'all. So, unfortunately, we can't really say much to that.
Well, it's better than going to Random House and having your, you know, having to get an agent and speak to an editor and see if your book is actually going to make it into a publication house. And
I mean,
I'm not a publisher, but that's not for me to decide. But I think that ultimately, it's working for those who put the time in and develop their own marketing campaign and really put the effort into. I will say this: I don't buy stuff on DriveThru that does not have a solid preview. So if you're a publisher out there, and you're on DM's Guild, or if you're anything, and you don't show me a nice preview, I'm not buying your shit. Because you're lazy fuck.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a comment who says that unless, he says, the DM's Guild isn't particularly good in terms of the split, but unless your goal is to work for, like, Wizards of the Coast, at the end of the day, it's pretty challenging to, like, make it work for you. I presume when he says make it work for you, means in terms of, like, make a profit or a living off it.
But even going back to the golden age or whatever you want to it was not everyone who could make a living out of writing for a role-playing game.
Yeah,
and they made, you know what I mean, this is a hobby that at some point in time you can make money with, some money, but you know, you're not getting fringe benefits from it. You know, you're not getting dental, medical, and all this. This people have to sustain their livelihoods in a real way, and then if they get some money out of doing this, then fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same for any sort of like people who are like self-employed, effectively. Like you say, unless you have like the safety net of like a day job, effectively, you have to like work like doubly, triply as hard to make a go of it, doing what you love or what you're good at, effectively.
It was funny because when I was reading V5, one of the features of what you could do as a vampire at night, what would your livelihood be that would consume all of your time at night, one of the last bullets was game developer.
Yeah.
And I just, when I read that, I just chuckled because I know the guys who wrote that book, all they're doing is busting their ass. And, you know, it's all due credit to people who actually are in the industry full time.
because I'm going to tell you what, they're the unsung heroes in credits. One page of credits in front of the book is not enough for the amount of work that goes into publishing one core rule book or even just one source book.
Publishing a role-playing book or writing for role-playing games. So it has to come from the heart, as Johanna said.
Well, the fact is...
You have to struggle.
Well, the fact is, when it... Role-playing games, love them or hate them, they're a luxury item. Yeah. It's like, you don't, much as we all love RPGs, you do not need RPGs to like survive. You need to be able to like look after your family, feed them, clothe them, have a roof over your head. Those are like your essentials. And I think as sort of like people are finding like money maybe a bit tighter, people can afford fewer luxuries, people are being more selective and they're less willing to like spill out like massive amounts of money on books. I mean, even like myself, where like you guys were saying, like, oh, at the start of this one's all about getting a new book, you guys are like, oh, how many like new books do you get? Even like myself, compared to like the days when I used to like rack up these shelves and like buy like pretty much every book that was released from like White Wolf and whatever, even my sort of like amount of books I buy now has like decreased rapidly because there's like more important stuff.
It is a strange piece because like if you just invest in the core book, right, and let's say that's what, $40 to $50, and of course you have to put in the work yourself, but you can get a lot of hours out of that one time investment, and then you have people like you and me who tend to buy books and put them on shelves and collect them for some reason.
Don't know what you mean, Dennis. Don't know what you mean. All right. Strapping everyone. I'm about to go to OSR for a minute. Right. See, and I've said this before. That is one of the reasons why I've gone. Not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why I've gone more towards like the OSR stuff over the last year or two. It's because a lot of the PDFs of these games are pay what you want, or they're freely available. Now, for myself, because of like my epilepsy and my vision, I struggle to read like a PDF for like a long period of time on a screen. Now. So that means that if I end up wanting to run a game, I'm probably going to have to buy a hard copy of it just so I can have it there to like read. But because many of the OSR games offer the PDFs as like pay what you want, it means I can go online and just be like, all right, okay, doesn't matter if I've not got much money to spare this month. Boom, there's like 15 like free PDFs. I can then read through them, like find maybe like two or three that I really like, and I can then go, right, I can now make an informed purchasing decision based on what I've read, rather than just having to like look at like the front cover or the previews on drive-thru and go, I think that book looks good, I'll buy that. So that's another one of the reasons I go for the OSR stuff, because it allows me to make more of an informed choice about what I'm going to buy.
Yeah, that's, I think that goes for pretty much everybody who plays OSRs, you know. If it's free, it's for me. I agree.
And like, the longer you spend in this sort of hobby, like, unless you are a collector, you have the collector mentality, like, I think there definitely comes a point where you just sort of feel at least a little bit content with what's on your shelf.
Yeah, I mean, I think we do see that a lot in the sort of online communities where, and again, I'll use D&D as an example just because so many people who play it, where you get someone saying, we saw this last, I think, when D&D 5th edition was just being bought out, when you got a lot of people who were like, I've still got my 3.5, I can still run that. Why do I need 5th edition? Then you've got other people going, well, I've still got 2nd edition AD&D, so I don't need 3.5. And then you've got, I'm still playing BX Brown Box from back in 10 giggity 6, and that still plays as well as ever. So why do I need this?
Yeah. Because you know what happens is that all I have to do is gently nudge John with a new book that he says he doesn't need. I just, like, poke the bear.
It's because John has the 2-point floor.
I'm not buying B5. One month later, he's on Facebook. B5.
I will point out in my defense, I didn't buy that.
Oh yeah, somebody bought it for you. Johannes? Oh, yeah. See, yeah. Dude, you're nice.
He's only bought it because then he's going to be like, oh, be a shame if you got that nice V5 book, John, and you like didn't run a campaign of it.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you start buying role-playing books today, John, we could still be playing for the next 10 years at
That's
least.
Right.
It's not going to happen, Dennis. Don't panic.
I've seen John go through this before, though, like with the Star Wars books. When the Star Wars books came out, you know, why am I buying this core book? It's the same core book as the other core book, but only a few different rules. Buys all three core books, starts buying all the rest of the source books.
I will point out in my defense, I have got the three core books, you're absolutely right. However, I only actually have four of the other books.
Oh!
Yeah, I bought one of the books from like each of the lines, and then I bought like the Mask of the Pirate Queen adventure, and that was because I wanted to like rag a load of stuff from it for the game we were running at the time, Johannes.
Mm-hmm. I went a different way. I got one of the core books and just got all of the source books.
You can do, just give me a moment. I can see we've been joined by Colin in the Twitch chat, who runs the Spike Pit OSR podcast, which I'm a big fan of. I correspond with him quite regularly, so nice to see you, Colin. If you've got any comments, feel free to drop them in the chat and we'll try and answer them as we're sort of rambling on about production and stuff like that.
So, my thing is, what do you guys think? If you haven't heard, apparently Wizards of the Coast, in collaboration, I believe, with the Courier of Eberron, are doing this digital Eberron campaign. But what I found out, which was not until recently, is the actual production of it is staged. Like, so they've released it, but it's going to be expanded and added to over time. I believe they're going to refine it and possibly add more information, more. I think it's a little bit more than that, because I feel like it seems from what I was reading that they're collating feedback about what's already there from the people who are interested in it, and then expanding it from there.
Yeah, I think they release Wayfinders of Eberron, and yeah, and then from there they're just going to take the feedback from the community and really dive. I think it's almost the same thing that they did with how they created Xanathar's and Mordenkainen's.
Yeah, I mean, I'll certainly be interested to see what they do with that, because, man, I've got some of the 3.5 Eberron stuff, and I was like quite a big fan of it. I like the whole sort of like pulp slash noir sort of style D&D. I thought that was like an interesting juxtaposition of things.
I had a really great time. Had to pause it because I was running too many games. And
I see you came up with a novel way of solving that by running a load of V5 games.
By running
games.
More games, right?
Yeah.
I'm horrible.
It's a novel solution, man.
This is something that me and John go through all the time. We go through these ups and downs. It's like, I'm running too many games, I got to cancel. And then we're like, oh, we got to bring it back, but we're not going to bring those games back. We're starting a new game. And then it just goes on and on and on.
You just become inspired, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to admit, I'm already sort of like going, oh, well, I'm running like my West Haven game on alternate Sundays. And I'm like, I could fit a second game in.
I know, it's so hard. It's just insane, because you lie to yourself all the time. You're like, you stop the game that you played on Sunday, and then you play late Saturday, and then you feel great on Sunday, and you're like, dude, I feel, if I'm going to feel this way every Sunday, I might as well run another game. And then you get, it's a cycle of sickness, but it's so
fun. Yeah.
Can I just say, love the comments and the love for Lost Mine of Phandelver. That is an amazing one. That's my jam. I love that. Sorry, just off topic.
Yeah, this entire thing is off topic.
You know what? No, seriously, John, what you need to do is, we need to do this like twice a month, and don't put subject matter on the header. This is our time to have a round table and just bullshit.
What I like to do is I like to put a subject on there as like a starting point, but I'm under no illusions that by the time like 15 minutes have passed that we're still going to be talking about that topic.
You have that like a subheader that said that's just the start, and we're totally not going to talk about
that
for 4 hours.
We should end the podcast deciding what the title will be. Like, retroactively.
I like the contrast between this and the thing that we recorded, John, with Lloyd. Because Lloyd was like, I have the presentation prepared here, and we will follow these bullet points, and then it will
be done. Oh, did he really?
Oh, yeah. It was really cool. It was like me, Johannes, and Lloyd, and me and Johannes had like been at work, and we sort of like rolled in, and we were like, all right, we're going to talk about some like roleplay shit and whatever. And Lloyd was like, yeah, I've got the subject written down. I've got lots of questions written down. Right, let's go. And I was like, over to you, man. Take it away.
See, that's why he's in the industry, though.
And that's it, man. Yeah. That's why he's getting them Modifius dollars.
Modifius pounds, I guess.
Yeah, true.
That's
I got carried away.
we've just had Jay Chill in the comment section. He's like, yeah, I was going to say Lloyd kept you on track. You're absolutely right, Jay, man. He did, yeah.
Well, we won't do that.
But no, in all seriousness, I mean, I am hoping to do more of these sort of like online sort of uncut versions on Twitch, sort of streaming them, and then all I do is I just rag the sound out of them afterwards, edit it down and like upload it to the podcast so people can listen to it there. But yeah, I'd quite happily do like one or two of these like a month, just like rambling on about RPG stuff, because let's face it, I mean, even like when you're online and you're doing a game, like before the game and like after the game, or when there's like an interlude, we're all role players, we all like talking about the hobby, that's what we do. So,
and if you do not support Red Dice Diaries, do that. Go to his blog. Are you selling stuff? Do you have t-shirts or hats? You don't have anything? Get some, sir.
My problem with like Teespring and things like that is that if I go to like a t-shirt manufacturer's and they haven't got like at least an option for like 5XL t-shirts, I'm not interested. It's like it makes me laugh no end when you see that people are like, oh, we're selling like game based t-shirts, and they're like, yeah, oh, they go up to like 2XL. I'm like, have you ever met a role player?
They sell up to 6XL on Teespring.
See, Johannes is laughing there because he's like a lithe, like slip of a Finnish lad. Well,
I don't know. I had a blast. That's all I got to say. This was awesome. I'd love to do it again.
Okay, so does anyone have anything? Presumably, everyone's about ready to sort of like start wrapping up now. So I think we've like talked around, beyond, around the corner from the topic they were originally on. So does anyone else have anything they want to talk about, either related to the topic or any of the various other spiel we've done like before we close up?
You do play D&D.
No, I don't.
No, Andrew, you're going to make him have a nervous breakdown.
Just suck it up. You play D&D, Dennis.
Play Dungeon World, D&D with the number filed off. I mean,
yeah, but that, I mean, as far as, you know, if we were to run it, I think this harkens back to the question, if you were to run a company, what would you do? I would try and, there's actually three things I would do. I'd try to make something synonymous with the way D&D Beyond works for the game that I produce. Two, I would create an app for phones that allows shared dice rolling rooms, so, you know, you can roll dice and play the game mobile-wise and not be strung to your computer. And three, I would give away free PDFs and obviously deluxe print versions of the books. Oh, man. But yeah, no, I would like to do something like that. That would be pretty cool.
Speaking of like utilizing PDFs in different ways, I was really impressed with this Eclipse Phase first edition. They have a lot of like con games, so like designed for specifically to be run in like I think 4-hour time slots at conventions.
So just goes to show you, it's not what you roll, it's how you play.
You head in the game.
That's right. Yeah. No,
I tell you what, I would listen to an hour of Andrew just going through like.
But yeah, I think we've pretty much talked around the subject there, guys. I think we'll sort of wrap up there. So, thanks very much to Dennis, Johannes, Andre, and Matthew for joining me. Thanks to everyone who was in the chat, commenting and getting involved. Great to have people like inputting. We're going to try and do these on a sort of like semi-regular basis, depending on like who we can get to, obviously time schedules and whatever, who we can get to actually be in these. So thanks very much for joining me, guys. Has anyone got any thoughts they want to close out on?
Red Dice Diary swag is coming.
If you have a Roll20 module that you would like Andre to purchase, you can find him at...
or just like lean out of your nearest window and go... Roll 20, and he'll hear you wherever he is. He'll hear you.
No, but thank you for
for hosting this, man. I had a great time, and I hope to do this again on a more regular basis.
Well, like I said, I mean, obviously, schedules depending. I would love to do like one of these like every couple of weeks or whatever, just see how we go on that. But I don't know if any of the rest of you guys would be up for something like that potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, we'll have a bit of a chat about it on Facebook and whatever. Obviously, I'm happy to talk for a bit after we finish the stream, but to now just say thanks to you guys, thanks to everyone in the chat, and I'm going to stop the stream shortly. So take care, guys, we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
So that's it for this episode. If you have any questions or suggestions for things you'd like to see in the podcast in future, please either email them to reddicediaries@gmail.com or drop me a voicemail at Anchor. Until I see you next time, whenever you're playing, take care and enjoy yourselves.